Welcome back to There Is a Season, the Pete Seeger podcast. There Is a Season is a podcast devoted to reevaluating the work, music, and politics of the late American folk musician Pete Seeger. On this show, we work towards rediscovering and getting more in touch with Pete Seeger's contributions to better understand how we can more fully apply them now and in the future. In this episode today, I will discuss my reactions to and thoughts about the recent film, A Complete Unknown. I will focus on several things, ranging from how effectively the characters were written, to the extent to which we get to see how Dylan is influenced by other people and other musicians. Additionally, I focus on what Dylan and Seeger really thought of each other, and what Pete's reactions actually might have been to Dylan's electric set at Newport, 1965. December 2024 saw the release of James Mangold's film, A Complete Unknown, a story encapsulating the tale of musician Bob Dylan arriving in New York City from Minnesota in January of 1961, chronicling his rise to stardom. The film, which is based on author Elijah Wald's 2015 book Going Electric, culminates in the Newport Folk Festival of 1965, and depicts the confusing and complicated reaction to Dylan's electric set towards the end of the festival. The movie incorporates many musicians, Joan Baez, Woody Guthrie, Mike Bloomfield, Al Kooper, among others. The film also recognizes other people who were integral to Dylan's success, such as producer John Hammond, folklorist Alan Lomax, manager Albert Grossman, and, of course, Pete Seeger. This film for myself and many others was, as you can imagine, highly anticipated. As of the writing and release of this episode, I have now seen this film in the theater 3 different times, and will probably see it more. Much has been said online and in the media in the last several weeks since the film's official release on Christmas Day. Commentary has touched on the factuality of the movie versus how events have been fictionalized, and the presentation of the characters and the lack of other potential key players in Dylan's story in the early 60s. Topics have also ranged from the quality of the film's music itself to how it was presented and performed. In my discussion here, I'll certainly touch on most of these to begin this conversation, but I imagine my framing will ultimately be somewhat different than others. I do need to point out a couple of things, such as the fact that Seeger never wore a thumb pick, as that was not his banjo style, and we see Ed Norton wearing one in the film. Additionally, the term covers never would have been used at this time, nor was Where Have All the Flowers Gone an old song. That dialogue felt like someone speaking in contemporary times, and not in 1961. The truth is that Flowers was only a few years old at that point, and was still a pretty new song to people. Additionally, Judas was a shout appropriated from someone who yelled that in Manchester, England the following year when Dylan was on tour with the Hawks. While the vibe might have been similar, the whole exchange was not drawn from the Newport performance. I get it, it is thrown in there for artistic license to describe people's feelings in the audience, but for the sake of debunking obnoxious myths, I figured I'd mention it. Also, Pete Seeger does not speak in a grammatically incorrect way when he faced Judge Murphy at his sentencing in federal court in April of 1961. Nor does he just get to walk out of there and sing for people. As we discussed in the Blacklist episode, Pete was brought away in handcuffs, and bail had to be arranged for him before he could get out of jail. Additionally, Pete did not reference Woody Guthrie in his statement to the court. I understand why that line is in there to show how the spirit of Woody is present, but my point is the dialogue did go differently. What I have more beef with is the fact that Pete was not on trial for singing a certain song, but rather not answering questions about where he sang it and for whom. That was the charge of contempt of Congress. He was not in hot water just because he sang Wasn't That a Time. This is a facet of the Blacklist people still seem to be confused about. But on a more analytical level, my own lens through which I understand this film and what it represents will of course be focused on not just how Pete Seeger is depicted, but moreover the ways in which Pete Seeger's legacy will be affected by this film and its narrative. In my opinion, this movie is as much about Pete Seeger as it is about Bob Dylan. Whether James Mangold intended for the story to operate this way or not is up for debate, and we'll never really know the answer to that anyway. But for those of us concerned with what Pete Seeger's work, music, and politics means in 2025, I believe attempting to answer this question is essential. What I think is worth covering first is the acting and the music. In regard to this question, I would say that this is one of the stronger aspects of the film. I realize I say this as someone who has listened to Dylan for most of my life, but I do find that Timothy Chalamet's portrayal of Bob Dylan is very convincing. In terms of how the film and the character is written anyway, Chalamet is very engaged in his character, and I would argue that his musical performance is well done. For those that did not know, the musical performances in the movie were done live, right in front of the microphone, and this was probably a very smart decision. I will say that there are a few idiosyncratic moments when I think Chalamet loses Dylan's voice a bit or slips out of the role in his speech and dialogue, but there is an overall consistency, and the ways in which Chalamet shows Dylan's transitions into new musical forms are evident. The movie is written in stages, and we see Chalamet's representation of Dylan as a very green 19-year-old arriving in New York City, transforming definitively into a confident songwriter by 1965. In terms of the other characters, the movie is very partial in dialogue to Dylan's first love interest, the character Sylvie Russo. This character, played by Elle Fanning, is a take on the late Susie Rodolo, Dylan's first love interest when he arrived in Greenwich Village. According to what we have been able to read in the press, Dylan communicated with Mangold in select capacities about the film's script, and one of his specific wishes was that Rodolo's name be changed for filming. There are many who have said that Rodolo's character is not well developed, and we are left with gaps in understanding her. This is an interesting take. Personally, I struggle to talk about that without talking relatively about how Joan Baez's character is represented, for the reason that these two people are very influential in Dylan's life. I would take the line that it is Baez that is not well developed, nor is the nature of her partnership with Dylan. Baez has far fewer lines than Sylvie Russo, and we have to depend more on her body language and physical acting in order to understand her thoughts, feelings, and opinions more than any other character in the film. And thus I felt as if the ways her character was written was less balanced than Sylvie Russo's. Her musical partnership with Dylan is shown a bit with their duets, but the significance of their musical partnership and what brought them together is, in my opinion, somewhat vaguely implied. Girl from the North Country is a good performance by Barbaro and Chalamet in the film, but God on Our Side might have been a more accurate choice. Joan is more or less represented as a female love interest of Bob, who is a talented musician, but we do not see that their connection and partnership had socio-political significance for both of them at the time. This also goes along with how and why Dylan moved on from Baez. The causality behind this is not outlined very well for a general audience. What stands out to me most about the characterization of the key figures of the film is the extent to which we as the audience are able to see how the other musicians, friends, and partners in Bob Dylan's life had an influence on him. For example, for those that may not know, Susie Rodolo was one of the most important political influences Dylan had in his life in the early 60s. One of the reasons for this is because Rodolo herself was a quote-unquote red diaper baby and came from a very leftist background. If anyone wants a deeper understanding of Rodolo's life at this time, I suggest you check out her memoir, titled A Free Will in Time, a memoir of Greenwich Village in the early 60s. Among many tales she relates in the book about her relationship with Bob, Rodolo discusses her political endeavors in considerable depth. She explains how she traveled with other students between countries after the embargo was placed on Cuba to test the U.S.'s travel restrictions with the FBI hot on their trail, eventually how she met Fidel Castro, her civil rights participation in New York City, and her sister Carla working for Alan Lomax. When Dylan would write his songs during this period of time, he would often share his lyrics with Rodolo, getting feedback from her to make sure he was getting it right. Rodolo was working as a secretary at CORE, or the Congress for Racial Equality, and would share with Dylan the latest information about what was going on and where. It was also Rodolo who introduced Dylan to other poets and writers, such as Bertolt Brecht and Arthur Rimbaud. This was a monumental connection for Dylan as an artist, musician, and songwriter. In a sense, he was given the inside scoop on things he didn't know very much about. While Bob Dylan is, of course, absolutely dynamic as a creative individual, we ought to be cognizant of the fact that Dylan didn't really grow up that political. As a child, he was a middle-class rock and roller from the outskirts of Duluth, Minnesota, and was sheltered from the world in a variety of ways. This, of course, was not lost on Bob. He became aware of himself this way. He notes this in the 2005 Scorsese documentary, No Direction Home, when he says that his hometown of Hibbing was, quote, on its way to nowhere, unquote. Dylan wasn't necessarily putting down his roots here, but he was noting that it wasn't as real or as authentic as he wanted his life and world to be. I think that now in hindsight, we can look back and observe how Dylan's songwriting and artistic explorations have been about encountering the real, the meaningful, and the authentic, which helps explain his keen interest in what Susie was able to show him. As author Daniel Mark Epstein discusses in his book, The Ballad of Bob Dylan, Bob is someone who works off of perceptions. If he senses something and becomes curious about it, if something seems incongruous or strange, it is worth investigating, and he will go down that road and check it out. If it has to do with inequality or war or any other social ill, Bob might think about it more if it triggers that perceptive part of his thinking. As we know, Dylan on the whole isn't necessarily a political writer, as his perceptions have led him to writing about so many other things. But during the era in which A Complete Unknown takes place, in regard to Dylan's political socialization, Susie Rodolo knew something that Bob did not, and this led him down that road of discovery. Without Susie, who knows? Maybe we wouldn't have songs like Hard Rain, or Talkin' John Birch Blues, or The Times They Are A-Changing, or maybe even Blowin' in the Wind. What I believe is most troublesome in this film is that influence, that causality, that genealogy of events is not as well connected as it could be. Sure, we have a scene where Sylvie is telling Bob her schedule and how involved she is in volunteering for social and political causes, but how all that diffuses into Bob artistically is neither deeply discussed nor demonstrated. I know some people might say you can't include everything, and I know you can't, but this connection is integral to Dylan's development and transformations as a musician between 1961 and 65. It would have been helpful to see Dylan asking Sylvie about what was going on at Core, or a scene where Dylan was writing one of his political tunes that Sylvie would take a look at and provide feedback for him. Another alternative might have been some sort of physical acting or eye contact that illustrated that it was Susie Rodolo's impact that played a role in making these songs. Even a scene at the Brandeis University concert in the spring of 1963 might have been helpful, as that was a program where the audience received Dylan's political songs with open arms. In any event, I think that this is key to the story, and would have helped show how things move from one thing to the other instead of appearing to happen somewhat spontaneously out of the blue. For Dylan fans and folk music fans who already know this stuff, it isn't as much of an issue because we already know that story. But for the rest of the world, I think that this would have been helpful.
Oh, my name, it is nothing. My age, it means less. The country I come from is called the Midwest. As taught and brought up there, the laws to abide. And that the land that I live in has God on its side. The history books
What I think also would have benefited from more attention is a deeper understanding of what the Newport Folk Festival was really all about. Representation of working-class populations and the philosophy behind Newport is not shown nearly as much as it could have been. For those that do not know, this was the core of Alan Lomax's objectives behind song collecting. Lomax's chief interest was recapturing and presenting working-class consciousness in its raw musical form, and sharing that with the wider world to tell people stories and realities. Lomax emphasizes this in his 1993 book, The Land Where the Blues Began, where he broadly discusses how, in terms of the subject of blues anyway, debt peonage and the social relations of capitalism under Jim Crow and on the plantation constructed the vernacular of blues music. To alter this, in Lomax's mind, would inhibit these vernaculars from being communicated fully. This is a place where Lomax and Seeger would slightly disagree. Pete wanted to present authentic rural music, but he knew that to capture the interest of younger people, newer acts would have to be included. Knowledge of this is a key part of the story in relation to Dylan's electric performance. As such, it would have been helpful if they were trying to demonstrate how Lomax was frustrated by not just Dylan's set, but also the Butterfield Blues Band, who played earlier on during the festival before Dylan. And okay, we see a scene where the festival board is planning things, and Lomax reacts angrily to Peter Yarrow, who suggests the Butterfield Band, but we don't really get an explanation as to why Lomax doesn't want them there. As a side note, it was the Butterfield Blues Band's performance that led to the backstage fistfight between Lomax and Albert Grossman, which occurred then and not during Dylan's set on Sunday evening. Instead of trying to show this, the film cops out to a degree when Lomax is yelling at Dylan at the motel, telling him what real folk music is. The truth is that while Lomax was a purist in certain regards, he was a very complicated person in his own right, and as such I don't think that the narrative constructed around him does justice to the eclectic variety of music that the Newport Folk Festival was all about at the time. Sure, we get a scene where they're planning the acts, but I feel like Lomax's character and objectives could have been more critically communicated. They do attempt to provide some juxtaposition with the black singing group shown performing right before Dylan goes on with Al Kooper and the Butterfield Band, but the meaning of this falls short. Like I stated above, Pete Seeger, Lomax, and others were in some contention about designing a music program where the old and the new could be presented, but I think that what Lomax's radical objectives were are sort of lost on the audience. And again, yes, you can't have everyone in the film, and it would be too long. But it wouldn't have been impossible to have Gene Ritchie, or Sarah Ogan Gunning, or Mississippi John Hurt, or Frank Proffitt, or Son House, or Skip James doing a couple performances. Additionally, we only really see the main stage. The other smaller workshops on the other stages aren't present, and Dylan's recorded performances at those are also very revealing. And yes, the purpose of the movie was not to showcase the unique nuances and objectives of Newport as a whole, but in regard to the reaction to Dylan's electric set, something to create this backdrop would have provided some much-needed context. What is also somewhat absent is Dylan's direct association with singing at certain civil rights rallies, notably the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee rally that Seeger and Theodore Bekele brought him down to in Greenwood, Mississippi in July of 63, something we discussed in our last episode. All of these events also dictate how involved Pete was in supporting Bob and helping to get his music out there. To a certain extent, this is true to the film. It does come off that Pete was very generous and was significantly responsible for presenting Bob Dylan to the world. But in regard to the cultural backdrop of where and why, we don't get the whole picture. It wasn't just that Pete saw Bob as a creative individual. It was what Bob was saying in his music at the time that also caught Pete's attention. If they weren't going to show Greenwood, then perhaps they could have shown Bob singing lead on Blowin' in the Wind at Newport 63, with the Freedom Singers, Peter, Paul, and Mary, and Pete locking arms together and providing backup vocals for Bob. A time before this would have worked as well. As I briefly mentioned in the Albums of the Early 60s episode, the first opportunity Seeger seized for getting Bob out there for an audience was the Carnegie Hall Hootenanny in September of 1962. And it wasn't just Seeger. Others like Izzy Young, who ran the Folklore Center, where Bob spent a lot of time reading, studying, and listening to music, as well as manager Albert Grossman wanting to get Dylan out there, and wanted people to hear his songs. Although perhaps Grossman's motivations were different than Seeger's. Amusingly, Seeger is quoted by Elijah Wald as saying about Grossman that he felt sorry for people that had to work with him. But despite this, they all knew Dylan had a spark in him and thought he could really reach people. There is no doubt that Seeger was, of course, very fond of Dylan. When interviewed by his biographer David Dunaway in 1977, Pete discussed his early interactions with Dylan and what he thought about him at the time, focusing on his interactions with Bob at the Greenwood concert and the September 1962 Hootenanny. I'm going to share that passage now, with Dunaway asking the questions and Pete responding, and we'll pause between each line so you folks can identify who is saying what. It's Dunaway who begins speaking here. Quote, "Do you recall Bob singing 'Only a Pawn in Their Game'?" "Yes." "What did people think?" "Well, they thought it was an interesting song. It was a thoughtful song, and I think they probably agreed with it." Bernice Regan has a memory they reacted that his voice was a little harsh and difficult to listen to. They weren't used to his voice. Do you recall that as well? "No, I'm not sure they were used to it. Yes, it was perplexing. They had to strain to figure out what he was all about. He was so weird." "What did you think of him?" "I just thought he was a very talented songwriter. Still do. I am very envious of him." Someone talks about you and says that you are actually going around and telling people that this kid has got to be a genius. Does that sound like something you said? "Yes. Song after song rolled out. High quality." "Were you friendly at Greenwood?" "In his laconic way, Bob doesn't talk much. At least not with me. I don't think with anybody. Friendly, though. About the most talking we ever did was when we went to a cafeteria to have a pizza before the 1962 Hootenanny. Maybe it was just after. And I was really impressed with Hard Rain's Gonna Fall. He says, 'I'm working on a new one.' And he pulls out Davy Moore. He was working on the verses on a little piece of paper in his pocket." "How would you characterize his attitude towards you?" "Oh, I think he was interested in learning. But his great strength was his objectivity. He's not real cool." "I think in 1962 he called you a saint. A living saint, in Broadside magazine. Do you recall reading that?" "Yes, he uses words I wouldn't. He probably tossed it off just to get rid of the question." Unquote. For me anyway, this is an interesting passage. For one, I think it shows that Pete had a critical understanding of who Bob was at the time as a somewhat autonomous artist. Even if Pete did not understand everything Bob was doing musically, he probably had enough insight to know that Bob knew things that he, Pete, had never really thought about very much. Pete did more than just say that Bob was a genius, though. During the world trip from 1963 to 64, Pete sang Hard Rain nearly everywhere he went, among other Dylan songs, not to mention what he sang during the We Shall Overcome concert, which Bob attended in June of 63. Thus, the extent to which there was an implied or unspoken antagonism from Bob's side towards Seeger, as expressed in the film, is somewhat of a misleading narrative. In his book talk on Going Electric at the Library of Congress in 2015, Elijah Wald explains that Pete and Bob sent letters back and forth to each other up until close to the time that Pete died. Thus, the distance and awkwardness the film represents between Seeger and Dylan may not be 100% warranted.
"Where have you been, my blue-eyed son? Where have you been, my darling young one? I've strayed on the side of 12 misty mountains, walked and I've crawled on 6 crooked highways, been out in front of a dozen dead oceans, been 10,000 miles in the mouth of a graveyard. It's hard, hard, hard.
This brings us to the scene from the movie where Pete is taping an episode of his local television show, Rainbow Quest. Now, if there is one scene that I will critique, folks, it's this one. And I will get a little factual here because I believe it is relevant. Hopefully in a few months I'll have a more in-depth episode about Rainbow Quest, but for those unfamiliar, this was a 39-episode series Pete and Toshi produced together that showcased both older and newer talents playing music in the folk and roots traditions. People like Hetty West, Mississippi John Hurt, Richard and Mimi Farina, the Stanley Brothers, Johnny Cash and June Carter, Judy Collins, Len Chandler, Donovan, and Buffy St. Marie were guests, among many others. The show was produced from late 1965 through the spring of 1966 in a small studio in Newark, New Jersey. Given the time during which the one series show was made, it all happened after the Newport Folk Festival of 1965, not before. Secondly, it was never done live on television. Thirdly, Dylan never crashed the show, nor appeared on the program at all. And fourthly, the blues singer character, Jesse Moffat, was totally fictional, although he was actually played by Muddy Waters' son, Big Bill Morganfield. Why is the scene here, and what is it all about? Well, for one, before A Complete Unknown was released in theaters, it was noted in the press that Dylan had potentially communicated to filmmakers that a certain scene that was completely made up be inserted into the film. And sure, we'll probably never really know, of course, but it's very possible this one was it. What I firstly find frustrating is that the Jesse Moffat character is drinking when he's performing, and for the record, no one ever drank on Rainbow Quest. Some may disagree with me, but this behavior and how it is supposed to make Pete look awkward is a little perplexing and disappointing, on top of the fact that it perpetuates stereotypes that it doesn't need to reproduce to make its point. Part of this stereotype is how the writers have Ed Norton describe the Jesse Moffat character as being from the deep Mississippi Delta, which constructs this annoyingly timeless, exotic geographical imagination of blues singers from the South, suggesting that the Delta is one thing and it never changes, whereas its history is far more complex than this. When Dylan shows up and comes out to play and jams with Jesse, we might take this to be a demonstration of Dylan's versatility as a musician. Another theme demonstrated is when Pete joins in with the banjo, to perhaps show both ethnic and musical connections between genres of folk and roots music that are cousins of one another. It may also be illustrating how Dylan and Seeger shared some important philosophical common ground between them, despite what happens later at the festival with Dylan's electric set. Either way, in my opinion, this seemingly wild fictionalization, while entertaining at points for some, doesn't tell the story of Seeger and Dylan's relationship as well as it could have. It would have been just as simple to show a performance of what is believed to be the one recorded duet that exists between Dylan and Seeger, that being the two guys at Newport 64 singing the tune "All You Playboys and Playgirls Ain't Gonna Run My World." This is a highly political song, and exposure of this might have shown more effectively how Pete helped to open up Bob to the world and open up the world to Dylan, respectively. Additionally, it would have shown Dylan's respect for Seeger, which I don't think was communicated as well as it could have been. I'm not saying this was entirely absent in the film, but I don't know how well this message was really communicated. We can note this in the passage that Dunaway references above, with Dylan calling Seeger a saint in Broadside magazine. This is indeed true. Bob did write this in a letter that he sent to Broadside that Sis Cunningham and Gordon Friesen published in Broadside's January 1964 issue. The letter is long and is very much in Dylan's prose, but here is the selection where he talks about Pete this way. Quote, "I'm listening to Pete sing Guantanamera for the billionth time. I don't have many folk music records. I don't have many records, really, but I do have that one of Pete's. God, it's like a go in a trance. He is so human I could cry. He tells me so much. He makes me feel so good. It's as though all the things that are sold to make one feel better ain't none of it worthwhile. All the cars and clothes and trinkets and foods and jewels and diamonds and lollipops and gifts of glad tidings just don't do nothing for the soul. I believe I'd rather listen to Pete sing Guantanamera than to own everything there is to own. That's my own private selfishness shining through there. Yes, for me, he is truly a saint, and I love him perhaps more than I could show, as always is the case." Unquote. The level of respect and admiration that we see here truly speaks for itself. Thus, the scene in the hotel room where Pete confronts Bob about potentially playing electric is also somewhat perplexing. The story Pete tells about filling in sand as fast as it is pouring out of a bucket is a metaphor Pete often told later in life. The analogy of Bob bringing a shovel is Pete saying how important a voice Bob has is, and that it would be great for him to use that voice instead of doing something else during his set that evening. In actuality, it's hard to believe Pete got in Bob's face beforehand about this, and Bob storming out of the hotel room in mid-conversation with Pete is not what their relationship was really like. They had respect and admiration for one another, and we ought to look on with skepticism about any major micromanaging going on by Pete. It's there, of course, to show us that Bob was going to do his own thing, and was moving on from the scene to find new artistic and musical horizons. So poetically, like Elijah Wald has said, it is accurate. At the same time, I hope we can appreciate that the dogmatic representation is maybe a bit sensationalized.
Oh, ye playboy.
one line changes its verse. You fall out shelter sellers, can't get in my door, can't get in my door, can't get in my door. You fall out shelter sellers.
And now lastly, in regard to the electric set at Newport itself, I do think it is worth noting that a substantial amount of fictional license is taken. I won't dissect it here too much myself, because there's already been a decent amount of press on this, but I will make a couple points. For those that have complained that there is no mention of the Vietnam War, Elijah Wald has addressed this in his online posts. Joan Baez and Len Chandler were practically the only people to acknowledge the question of Vietnam at the festival. As of the summer of 1965, the Vietnam War, while it was becoming a major issue, was not major news yet, and only a few people in the folk community had commented on it in song thus far, notably Phil Oakes on his first album with the song Talking Vietnam. Baez briefly sang a couple verses criticizing Lyndon Johnson, and Len Chandler made some critical comments during a set which, according to Wald, got a mix of applause and boos. And before I forget, let me speak directly to the Phil Oakes fans out there. I'm a Phil Oakes fan too, and the complaint that Phil is completely left out is frustrating, just like Jack Elliott, Fred Neil, Richard and Mimi Farina, and others who are an important part of Dylan's scene were left out. But please, let us not use this as an excuse to perpetuate the trope of the imagined feud between Bob and Phil. It never really existed in the ways that people so often want to believe that it did. Maybe we can lay that one to rest. In terms of the day of Dylan's set, what we don't explicitly see is the excitement caused by the rain earlier in the day, nor the problematic sound check where Peter Yarrow is losing his mind over levels before the evening performance. Part of the sound problem was that amplification was new to the sound folks at Newport, and they didn't really know how to set it all up. As the story goes, Pete was frustrated over how loud the electric performance was because people couldn't hear the words, and in the moment was probably frustrated about the levels and perhaps couldn't understand why Bob was, in his mind, being so flippant. In truth, the sound system resulted in Dylan's voice being inaudible nearer to the stage, and the balance with the instruments was off, although Wald explains that from further away, it would have sounded okay. Dylan and the Butterfield Band only played 3 songs that night because that was all they had rehearsed for, and even still, the band struggled to get through them, which also probably contributed to the chaos. Their 3rd song, Phantom Engineer, which eventually became It Takes a Lot to Laugh, It Takes a Train to Cry, had its rhythm all over the place, and bassist Jerome Arnold had trouble following Dylan's changes. The whole legend about the axes may have come from some dialogue that was exchanged on stage right after Dylan and the band finished their set. People were screaming all sorts of things, much of it negative, but not all. Some people, Wald demonstrates in his book, enjoyed it very much, especially with how lead guitarist Mike Bloomfield was basically out to cut the air with his guitar playing. Dylan had released Bringing It All Back Home in March, half of which was electric music, and he had released a single of Like a Rolling Stone on July 20th, just before the festival, and some people had shown up wanting to hear this new sound. In the moment, though, many were calling for Dylan to come back and play more, which may have resulted in this tall tale about Pete. Elijah Wald explains in his book about an exchange between festival producer George Wine and Peter Yarrow. Quote, "The audience is still yelling, and Yarrow tries to cool them with a touch of hipster slang, unwittingly launching one of the evening's most persistent legends. At the side of the stage, too far off mic to be heard clearly, there is aggravated chatter, and someone, it sounds like Wine again, says loudly, 'Leave that one alone, Pete,' followed by an indistinct response in Seeger's familiar timbre. At roughly the same moment, on the microphone, Yarrow is trying to reassure the audience and says, referring to Dylan rather than Seeger, but using a jazz musician's term for the guitar, which some audience members clearly misconstrued, 'He's gonna get his axe.'" Unquote. So, the ultimate question, where was Pete during all this confusion? By all accounts, Pete was irate. Some claimed that once the unbelievably loud music began, Pete turned a deep shade of crimson and disappeared. As Wald has noted, it was Toshi who eventually straightened Pete out on this when the performance was going on. Mika Seeger, Pete's daughter, is quoted as saying her father was never against electric music, just that the sound was so distorted. As Pete recollected in the 1990s, quote, "I was furious that the sound was so distorted you could not understand a word that he was singing. He was singing a great song, Maggie's Farm, a great song, but you couldn't understand it. And I ran over to the sound man, said, 'Fix the sound so you can understand him.' And they hollered back, 'No, this is the way they want it.' I was so mad I said, 'Damn, if I had an axe, I'd cut the cable right now.'" Unquote. There is the story that producer Paul Rothchild actually saw Seeger with an axe, but otherwise this is unconfirmed. Wald quotes an account from George Wine, who claimed to have found and apprehended Pete out behind the stage. As Wine apparently stated, quote, "The rest of us were just as shocked and upset, except perhaps for Grossman, who must have relished the moment. After a few excruciating minutes, someone tapped me on the shoulder. 'Pete's really upset. Maybe you should go talk to him.' I found Pete sitting in a parked car in the field behind the stage. 'That noise is terrible,' he cried. 'Make it stop.' I said, 'Pete, it's too late. There's nothing we can do.'" Unquote. In any event, the truth about this has been told, retold, and negated so many times that we may never really know the full story. In regard to the booing, the public's perception of this has almost always been what is represented in the footage released by Murray Lerner, who, according to Wald, doctored the tape and sound and dubbed louder boos over the end of Dylan's performance to make it look like there were more boos than there were in actuality, thus making it even harder to have an accurate understanding of the nuances and the responses of the 17,000 people in the audience. But in regard to how Pete attempted to make sense of the whole event, Wald also discusses a note Pete wrote to himself a few days later, worried about if he had complicated matters. Quote, "Who knows? But I am one of the fangs that has sucked Bob dry. It is in the hope that I can learn that I write these words, asking questions I need help to answer, using language I never intended, hoping that perhaps I'm wrong. But if I am right, hoping that it won't happen again." Unquote. Pete continues this thought in a note he sent to his father with a copy of Dylan's album John Wesley Harding after that record was released in 1967. In it he says, quote, "Maybe Bob Dylan will be like Picasso, surprising us every few years with a new period. I hope he lives as long. I don't think there's another songwriter around who can touch him for a certain independent originality, even though he is part of a tradition." Unquote. Overall, Pete felt as if the musical sharing process had already been compromised a bunch with the Newport Festival, and long had felt that rock and roll was a pacifying force, causing people to ignore real issues. If Pete was frustrated with Bob, it was over the idea that people would be distracted from the building of mass consciousness as enabled, in his mind, by more traditional folk music. But this quote shows that Pete understands that while something like Maggie's Farm may sound different, he still sees that there is a message to be heard, and Bob's work is still a product of folk and roots music. Indeed, Maggie's Farm could not have been written without having been influenced by those traditions. And it's not like everyone who came to Newport was interested in the older, rural performers. Many just wanted to hear the new stuff. Thus, while folk music can do a lot, who is to say it will inevitably lead to the consciousness building we'd like it to construct? Dylan's electric set was the next progression waiting to happen. While some like Pete might have not fully observed it in the moment that night in July of 1965, I don't think we can deny that Maggie's Farm or Like a Rolling Stone aren't protest songs. They are protest songs, not just of Dylan's individualism, but protest songs about much, much more. It is in many respects our responsibility as the audience to recognize this. It is neither Bob Dylan nor Pete Seeger that are responsible. If we are to learn anything from Bob or Pete and this strange moment in American cultural history, we must appreciate that with the music we, the audience, the people, must actively create our consciousness with what exists. We shouldn't let it happen to us. We should not let it happen on its own. On the contrary, we should make it happen for ourselves.
Preacher in the pulpit, shouting with all his might, glory, hallelujah, puts the people in a fright. You might think that Satan's coming up and down the aisle, but it's only the preacher putting on the style, putting on the agony, putting on the style. That's what all the young folks are doing all the while, And as I look around me, I'm very apt to smile. You see so many people, but none a style.
Let me just say that, at a certain point, and to quote Pete, this is all petty carping. I enjoyed seeing this film. While there may have been some marketing designed around nostalgia in a movie released during the holidays, to say that's all this is a bit cynical. There's a lot going on here, and as Dylan says in Pennebaker's film Don't Look Back, you're not going to get it all the first time. For the first time in a very long time, we see Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie's names up there again. If this film opens people up to encountering this music, then these are all good things. Who knows? Maybe a new generation will discover this and run with it, just like the impact the No Direction Home documentary had in the mid-2000s. And this is one of the essential questions with which we have grappled in this podcast since it began in the fall of 2023. That is, what is Pete Seeger's legacy, and how can we protect it and help it survive so it can see another day? As long as we go into understanding a discourse like A Complete Unknown in a critical way, I believe we can potentially see this as an overall positive transgression. We have no idea exactly what Pete Seeger would say about all this, but I'm sure it would be something hopeful. Folks, thanks for joining us for this episode. I realize this has been such an anticipated film, and a lot of people love it. A lot of people are not into it. I think we can expect that. And there's so much happening in this movie, I probably missed a bunch of things that I would have wanted to talk about anyway. But I think that what I mentioned was what I think deserves the greatest amount of attention relative to Seeger. And like you heard me say, my biggest issue is just the causality. And how does Dylan get his ideas? Where do they come from? They don't just randomly come to his head. Some of the ideas pop into his head and the songs just flow out of him. But it comes from somewhere else in the beginning, and Susie Rodelot is a big piece of that. I didn't put it in my script, but I just wanted to quote this piece of her book from page 290 if people want to look up A Free Will in Time. What she says about Bob, quote, "Our time together fed his work. I know I influenced him. We marked each other's lives profoundly. He once told me that he couldn't have written certain songs if he hadn't known me. I served as his muse during our time together, and that I don't mind claiming," unquote. Which I think is just really interesting to hear. So just something to bear in mind. And also, of course, Elijah Wald, you should read his book, Going Electric, Dylan Seeger and the Newport Folk Festival, because it talks about all the different possibilities of what could have happened, and the idea that we have to believe the story about Paul Rothchild claiming that Pete had an axe just as much as Pete's story that he was just frustrated about not hearing the words is, you know, Elijah Wald saying that's equally as believable. We have to understand that because with a historical event like this, we can't really know the truth. It was such a complicated thing that happened, but and really interesting to think about what it all represents symbolically and what it means, and to understand how the 17,000 people in the audience reacted to it. It's hard to know what everybody thought and what everybody heard in different places in the audience. This is part of the challenge, but it's fun to think about. And also, please, if you're interested in all these subjects, if you're just joining us, welcome. Please feel free to follow us on Instagram, follow us on Facebook. And if you are interested in supporting the show, you may join the Patreon. patreon.com/PeteSeegerPodcast. And there's different tiers you can join if you'd like to support the show. It'd be great if we could get a few more supporters, then we could cover distribution. It'd be really cool. Anyway, hopefully our next month or next episode, whenever it happens, will be on the world trip. And after that, we'll have a more in-depth discussion of Pete's involvement, sort of leading the Newport Folk Festival over those years in the early and mid-60s. At that point, we'll talk more about Rainbow Quest, I think, and have some more interviews in the spring. So there's some exciting stuff to come. Hopefully you stick with us. Anyway, stay well. We'll see y'all next time.